back, session number 30951, reel 2.
So can you, so when we're talking about your interview, can you tell me what kind of, what was BOAC like at that point of time? What was the organisation like?
It was very small. We also had BEA. So BOAC did the international flights. BEA did Europe. And in fact, strange enough, and I hadn't thought about it, there is a stewardess living not very far from me who was flying on the Stratocruisers to the States. So there are at least two of us still talking around. But it was 40 first-class passengers. Now, that gives you some idea of the size of the aeroplane. And for the 40 first-class passengers, we had two stewards and a stewardess to look after them. No, three stewards and a stewardess to look after them. I was posted to the African route. There were Far Eastern, African, Australian, South America in those days, and North America. So there were different fleets, each one sort of fairly autonomous, so whichever one. I was posted to Africa to fly on the brand new aeroplane Hermes, and I took out funds if I flew it. I was stewardess on the inaugural flight.
Can I stop you, because it would be wonderful just to know about your training as well.
So we could talk about training before we skip that bit. We had to do what I would term fairly rigorous stewardess training, and so we had to learn how, mostly to this day, it's dish and plate appeal. So that question mark on your face. So when you put a plate down in front of a passenger, it is appealing. You would like to eat it. And there's a lot in presentation, of course, I mean, to this day. I mean, we didn't even start to do what the chefs are doing today, but we were taught that you presented a very nice plate. You wiped the bits off around the side. A cold drink, you put the glass in something or other and then stuck it in sugar so they had a frosted edge. Cucumbers, you'll see at lunch today, are serrated round the sides. Tomatoes were crowned. The little things. And then we had first aid courses and how to deliver babies and, you know, sort of obvious things. So it was quite hard work, and we had to pass our thing. They took us all up on a flight. So if anybody would have been going to be violently ill, they might have done with any luck while they were training. And so we went on a flight out of London Airport, sort of circuit and bumps, or, you know, round and back again sort of thing. And then I was posted to the Hermes.
And where did the training take place?
At Heston. It used to be an aerodrome there, I think, in the old days, so it was at Heston.
And which year is this, just so I
1950. Yeah, so I went to Australia in March, I think, 1950, and started flying about the September, October that year, something like that.
And when you were training, I'm really interested in the training, just wondered what
if
else,
because
it's
remember.
So different. Did there things like dress or did
oh,
things like
sure.
that come up?
Oh, sure. I mean, well, we were going to have uniforms. So we had uniform, which was collar and tie, very much a male army kind of uniform, you know, skirt and heels, which were allowed sort of about 2 inches high kind of thing. I must say most of the girls certainly followed their thing that you had to have this reasonable relationship between height and weight. So you weren't necessarily very tall. Or even short, you know, you were, as they said. We had to learn how to do the briefing, because, for instance, on the Hermes, we had two cabins, that sort of thing. And so you had to do the briefing about the emergency exits, the things dropping out of the air if you've needed oxygen, all the things that today come over on a video or something like that, you had to stand and do. And then having done one, sort of pull the life belt over your head and everything, you take it off and you go into the next cabin and do it all over again, no PA system. So you had to learn how to do briefings. And generally what you did in an emergency, so you had to have desert drill and you had to have ditching in the sea drill and those sort of...
What did desert drill involve?
I don't remember now. I think it was keep in the shade if you possibly could. So we did have an aircraft. We did have a Hermes come down in the desert. And they actually rescued them all. They were fine. And they were only there a couple of days. And because the aircraft came down fairly intact, they were able to sort of... There was water and stuff on board. And they were able to shelter under the wings and keep themselves from being vastly dehydrated and were picked up, I mean, you know, quite quickly, because we did have wireless. Our navigation was through the bubble in the top. I used to wonder what will happen if it's terrible weather, but still we seemed first to get there. So we had radio operator, navigator, skipper and first pilot. I thought we had another one, engineer. Oh, sorry. So we had five crew and three stewardess.
I'm just wondering still with the training.
Okay. I don't think it was very much more.
Well, like the only thing I wondered was whether they gave you, how you were taught to behave with passengers and with crew.
If they got it wrong at the interview, you didn't need, you had to have that kind of, I don't believe that any of us hadn't got the gift of the gab, so to speak. And we, most of us were reasonably intelligent. You know, we had good educations. We had sort of, we weren't 18-year-olds. We'd knocked around a bit. And certainly I'd had a fairly out-of-this-world experience. So I guess probably for our ages, we were quite mature girls.
So your first posting was the Hermes.
Yes.
And can you give me a sketch? You've talked a little bit about it, but just paint me a picture of the Hermes.
Beautiful. Very old-fashioned now, of course. Just, it was one of the aircraft that had the wings on aircraft to have a dihedral and this sort of thing. And the Hermes was pretty flat. It was four piston engines, so it was a new engine. It was combining piston and the first lot of sort of comedy idea, you know. So it wasn't just a plain piston engine. It had crew, obviously, then the galley. The galley had little cooking facilities and coffee and tea and all that sort of thing. And then the cabin, and the cabin was split into two, you know, just bulkhead, as there is today, indeed, except you're splitting 360 now, probably. And we were splitting 40. And then at the back, two loos, men's loo and ladies' loo. And we had, for the first-class passengers, we had Elizabeth Arden's Bluegrass. And to this day, I can't bear Bluegrass. I'm not sure it even do it, but oof. And
is it a perfume?
Yeah, I mean toiletries, you know, sort of. Yeah, and perfume. And I mean, you always knew a stewardess because she'd smell of Bluegrass because she couldn't. It wasn't that she used it; she couldn't help it. And then equally things for the men. So that was sort of a snapshot of the aircraft.
What was it like to fly in?
Lovely. We had, when we started, we weren't allowed full power, so we flew slightly with our tail down, which was fine when you were serving and you went down, but when you came back up with heavy trays, it wasn't quite such fun. And there was I'll try and keep it very brief, but there was a funny story there. We had, because we were so new and we weren't flying with full power, they were not allowed to smoke in the cockpit, so it had a notice saying no smoking. And during the course of one flight to Africa, I was reading to some small child, and the skipper came and stood at my shoulder, and I came to a word which I thought, oh, he won't understand, you see. So I said something, the equivalent, in a much sort of easier to understand, and this child looked at me and said, can't you read? I had the skipper nearly fell apart laughing, so off he went. Anyway, a little bit later he sent that, because they did, you know, if you like to bring the kids up one at a time, you know, so I took this small child up, and he stood between the skipper, and they were smoking, because we had actually had the okay. So they got their cups, and they were smoking, with notice saying no smoking. So the child looked at the skipper and said, can't you read either?
That put him in his place.
Absolutely. I felt absolutely on top of the world. It was very hard work, even in those days.
Can you describe a typical flight for me?
Okay.
Right from the beginning, how would you get to the airport? What airport were you flying out of?
Flying out of London, sharing flat with six other stewardesses, I think, in Richmond at the time. We hardly ever saw each other. I mean, one was South America, one was North America, one was India, one was Australia, I was Africa. So it was very rarely we actually saw each other. Nice big flat in Richmond. We would get, the first thing we'd have is a letter from Rosters to say, you're flying wherever. This is your crew. And you could look at the crew and say, oh, no, not him again. Or you could say, absolutely lovely. Or there was one steward I absolutely dreaded because I started laughing the minute I met him and my tummy ached until I got home again. He was a dear, sweet man and very gay in those days, very gay. But, of course, they made excellent stewards because they loved doing, you know, forgive me, the sort of more woman's side. And so they made excellent stewards, and they all to one. I never met one who didn't have the most wonderful sense of humour. So that was fun. So you got your roster, you packed up. Mostly we were going to summer, winter here, or going to winter, summer here. So I actually had a tan all year round, which is quite nice. So you get your roster, you turn up, you'd be briefed on the journey, whatever they needed to tell you. You know, you were carrying a VIP or you'd got 79 children or something. Or we'd be taking a child special, you know. I mean, you could be doing something like that, which was really fairly unmentionable. Well, a holiday sort of school, going from school in England back to Africa, or vice versa sort of thing. And they were pretty hard work. You'd go out with your hands full of trays and they'd laced the seatbelts all the way across the aisle. Absolutely lovely, really great fun. So you learnt to hang on to a sense of humour. We really felt like a big whip, you know. Anyway, and we'd have a completely mixed bag of passengers, you know, from VIPs to going up to West Africa in those days, taking a lot of people whose husbands were working out there, who were then making money, I'm told, compared to being in England, who then had servants, so they had a nanny and a bar and a boy and a steward. And the difference in them going out, when they would ask me nicely if I'd do something, to when they flew back, stewardess, change it, will you, was very marked. But it was all experience. And we had our good experiences and our bad flying experiences, looking back.
So tell me, we were talking about a typical,
yeah.
Just try to get a sense of what okay. You would... I'm trying to get a sense of what your role
okay, so
was.
We did the briefing.
So we did the briefing, what
and
happens
then
next?
You go on board, you check that, you know, the covers on the seats are right, you check that you've got the food that you needed, you check... I'd do the bluegrass and sort of make sure the loos were absolutely right. So you all had... I mean, the stewards would be doing the galley, Skipper would be doing his checks. We all had our sort of tasks. And then they would say, OK, passengers coming on board. We only had we had one gangway in the front that the crew used and one at the back, which we used. And the passengers would come on board and you would stand there saying, good morning or good afternoon or whatever. Can I take your coat? Can I buy a seat number so-and-so, blah, blah, blah. Much as you do now, but only with 40 passengers. But in those days, 40 passengers was a lot. I mean, it was a full aeroplane, so... It's almost the same as having 360, but there were 40 and it was full. So, and then we'd do our briefing and tell them we were going to fly for how many hours and it was going to be at this height and there's the oxygen mask and there's your thingy and exits. So, and then go and strap ourselves in. We have a sort of jump seat at the back. And strap ourselves in for takeoff, and then once we were airborne, Skipper would say, okay, you know, you're all right now. So we'd be ready to start either a meal or just to go round, make sure my job, hostess, to go round and see everybody was comfortable, if they wanted a magazine to read, you know, sort of, I'd already told them where the loos were and that sort of thing, but, you know, just to sort of do a job you do at home, make people feel at home and comfortable. Quite often we got babies, so it meant going and making up bottles and things like that. So you could drone on. Now, going to Rome probably took us best part of 3 to 4 hours. And we'd serve a meal usually, as they do now, it sort of passes the time. The skipper would occasionally come through and sort of walk up and down and sort of. And then somebody would sort of say, who's flying the aeroplane? And he says, perfectly safe, madam, the first officer is in charge. Because flying was quite naive in those days. So and then typically you'd stay on board till you perhaps going to, so we were going down to Nairobi, we would stop in Rome, we'd all get off and stretch our legs, get back on again, and to Cairo. And there at Cairo, you'd have a slip crew waiting. So a new crew took over the passengers, and we were off to into Cairo to have 2 or 3 days, perhaps. Because in those days, there were only perhaps 1 or 2 flights out of London in a week. So wherever, we had to wait for the next flight. So if it was 2 days behind or 3 days behind, we had those 2 or 3 days, wherever we were. So swimming in the lovely swimming pool in Cairo, go to the bazaar and all the things that one did, but so safely those days, really. And then the next 2 or 3 days later, whatever, the aircraft comes in, and we are the slip crew, so we take the passengers on into Khartoum, for instance. Had an American on board once going down over Khartoum, and for some reason or other, I mean, they were always having problems in Africa, so for some reason or other, we couldn't go into Khartoum. So the skipper came back and said, "I'm terribly sorry, everybody, but we can't land in Khartoum. We've got to go on to wherever." So there was an American. He said, "Excuse me, stewardess, I wanted to see Khartoum." And I said, "Well, the window, you know, and the camera." So he said, "What a good idea." So he said, "Oh, well," he said, "that's it, I've done Khartoum." So, and then down to Nairobi or Victoria Falls, depending on what route we were going. And then you'd stop there. Nairobi, we were out at Limuru, which was up in the hills. And towards the end, before I stopped flying, it was the time of the Mau Mau, if anybody still remembers the Mau Mau, who were sort of natives who really were vicious and beheaded people and burned things and revolting neighbours. I shouldn't say revolting. They were in revolt. And it was really quite frightening. In fact, it got so bad that out at Limuru, the crew were issued with revolvers. The stewardesses were attacked. Most of the bedrooms were sort of littered around the grounds of this hotel. But the stewardesses were put in what they call Stewardess Alley, which was attached to the hotel. Now, you could say that we thought there was a double threat in this. They got guns as well, and we hadn't. But it was really, it wasn't very nice. So that was really a bit frightening, I think. We were all quite glad when we weren't doing Nairobi anymore. So that was sort of fairly typical. I could go the other way down to Tripoli, have a couple of days in Tripoli, go down to Kano. Again, it was constantly changing. Perhaps we'd stop in Kano for 2 days. Then on down to Lagos, Accra, on the beach at Accra, with the mammies coming round with fresh pineapples. And or else going down the middle, so to speak, to Victoria Falls and Entebbe, and then to Johannesburg. So that was the main sort of routes we took, sort of left, right and centre kind of thing. And you wouldn't know which one you were on. And at one time, quite honestly, I had my hair done in Rome and my washing done in Nairobi. I was never at home long enough.
Did you have a favourite
place? Rome. But having said that, I mean, Rome was a city. They told me in Rome we were at a different hotel. The cabin crew were at a different hotel from the skipper. And so they said, "We'll all meet in Rome," and I could get the bus in, you know, and the stewards had already gone. So I thought, and they told me that, you know, you have to be very careful in Rome because they do pinch your bottom. Well, I got there and nobody had, and I wasn't going to say so. So I said, "Yes, of course." So, and Rome and everywhere, all those cities were lovely and very safe to walk around on one's own. And sort of get into Rome and have a milkshake breakfast kind of thing. It's lovely, absolutely lovely.
Can you tell me about cooking on the...
Yes, it was the first, very few first flights. The first flight we took out, they cooked in these little oven things in the galley. And we did actually do silver service, you know, sort of with fork and spoon and peas and chasing them all around on the aeroplane. That, extraordinary. I mean, never again. We only did once, thank the Lord. And after that, we started to move into these prepared meals. I mean, they would be prepared. All we had to do was heat them up. So it was getting much closer to these today's food and presentation. But we did, and to this day, have to do a dish and plate appeal, which meant that any food, any drinks you served, had to be as nice and as attractive as you can make them.
And what kind of food was served?
Not sure I can remember now.
sorry.
And we used to do sort of things like steaks. I can't imagine what they were like. I mean, you know, you don't really do steaks in ovens and things, but you know, just ordinary food, I guess, as near as we could get it, and fruit and, you know, puddings and things, I think.
And you mentioned that you had first class passengers were given the Elizabeth Arden goodies. Sorry, excuse me. Were they given anything else? Were there any other?
Oh, yes. I mean, first class passengers, we had cigarette cases. We had fans because it was very hot, so they had the BAC fan. They had a plastic bag to put their shoes in. All sorts of things, you know, sort of really give away matches that were BAC matches. Silk scarves, we had very, very nice silk scarves. But all publicity.
And any memorable flights? Any that particularly have stuck with you?
Nice or nasty?
Either. Both.
Okay, going down to Accra. Beautiful blue sky, absolutely lovely day. Came out of Kano down towards Lagos, and suddenly I was standing in the cabin with magazines talking to a passenger without any warning at all, which is the worst kind, of course. We hit a hot air drop in a blue sky, and we went down. I mean, I can't remember how much, but it was enough to unseat passengers who didn't in those days stay strapped. And sort of about 60% of us hit the roof as we went down. And as we sort of virtually got their bottoms on the seat again, it happened again. And this time, I mean, I was fortunate. I'd managed to cling on to a seat back, and I had really fallen over. But when I got up, I mean, the place was bedlam. I mean, you know, there were people bleeding. And I went down the back. The steward was absolutely green. He'd obviously broken his arm. Obviously, you know, but I mean, he had broken his arm. So I sort of strapped him up and went round with first aid and cotton wool and stuff and strap people up or whatever. And what really got me was the door open. First officer came back and said, "Any problems up here?" "Oh, no. Oh, no. We've only got a steward and broken arm and a few people bleeding, but no, no problems." But the end of that story was when we got into Accra, the aircraft was checked and checked and double-checked. It had actually broken one seat entirely, so that was broken. And on the as we set off, as I normally did once people were set, I went round with magazines, and the first magazine I got to was literally covered in blood, so I thought, it's not a very good start to a flight, is it? So I didn't give that one out.
How terrifying. And any other?
Struck by lightning going into Rome, which was very interesting.
What did that feel like?
Actually, what I remember was we were flying in cumulus clouds, obviously in the thunder clouds, and the aircraft was doing, you know, side to side and up and down, and mostly when it was really bad, we strapped ourselves in as well, because there was no point in us injuring ourselves. We couldn't do much for the passengers. They got their sick bags, you know, and if they were going to be sick, they had to get on with it. So we were strapped in, but there was this sort of enormous crash, and somebody said they'd seen this ball of fire go up the cabin, you know. I didn't see it, but somebody said they did. Anyway, that was quite not very nice. But mostly, it was good flying. And, of course, we didn't go as high as they go today anyway, so we had sometimes a job to escape the weather. So we probably sort of had a bit more in the way of bumps.
So what happened next? How long did you do that for?
I did that for 3.5 years, until they disbanded the Hermes fleet. Well, two things, really. They were disbanding the Hermes fleet, and I was posted on to Argonauts to do the Far East. I hated the Argonauts with a hate. It had a little lounge thing at the back. It had midship's galley, so people going up and down to the loos and things had to keep walking through the galley, which was horrible. You didn't have the privacy of being able to prepare food and that sort of thing, because people were champing their way through all the while. I didn't like it. And because it was a very big fleet, on our little Hermes fleet, we began to know people, you know, after 3 years. And so this was an anonymous fleet, you know. You flew with people you didn't know. the interesting thing, of course, was the flights, because now I was doing India and out to the Far East, going into Japan. Going around Hong Kong in those days was an experience, because the runway was very small, and you had to, the skipper asked me if I'd like to go up front for landing, and I said yes, my first time. And you sort of had to bank round the peak, the big hill at the back, and you could sort of feel, oh, he doesn't go any closer because we're awfully close. And he had to do a very tight turn onto this small runway. So that was, Hong Kong was an experience to land. I gather now my daughter's done it since, and she said they've extended the runway. It's absolutely, they're vast now, you know. And she said, the thing is, as you go past, you're looking in people's windows. So anyway. Tokyo was a revelation to the crew, because all the women came out and carried the bags, and you know, and they were offered communal bathing, which I think some of them took to, rather enjoyed. And then coming back one time, we had to go into Okinawa, the Windy Island, and it was indeed. I mean, we had the most horrendous landing, with the wings sort of tipping up and down, up and down, up and down. But it was very nice, and then to do an entirely new route, sort of trying Karachi, Calcutta, Jakarta. No, Jakarta was when I went to Australia. Singapore, Thailand, places I'd just never been to. Hong Kong was wonderful. Stayed at the Peninsula, which even today is a famous hotel in Hong Kong. So we stayed at the Peninsula. We did always stay at very nice hotels. I mean, Skipper might have been one star up, but we were always in very nice hotels.
And what was the Argonaut like as an aircraft compared to the Hermes?
Well, as I said, it was four engines. It was, I thought, noisy. It had, the worst thing was the galley midships. It had this little seating lounge at the rear, which people could go and sit, sort of get up, you know, get up, move around. I guess it took about 40 passengers again. I mean, really, since it was not the love of my life, I sort of tend to about the Argonaut. The only pictures I've got of Hermes.
Did your routine for a typical flight vary at all?
Not really. It was like any job, which is what it was. Glam it might have been, and it wasn't when you were working. I mean, it was really, really hard work. Going down to another of the experiences was going down from Tripoli to Kano, which is completely over the Sahara. And in those days, it was a night flight, so the lights were out, people were dozing, people were sleeping, they were reading. So I used to sit down in the back, knit, I mean, you might as well do something. And the skipper came up one time and said, how's your desert drill? And I said, well, all right. Good, he said, we just lost number four. So a bit later on he came back, he said, you did say you knew what you were doing in the desert, didn't you? So I said, yes. Well, he said, I don't like the look of number two. And I mean, you know, my daughter had the cardigan until about, I think, 3 weeks ago, and I really said, darling, we have to throw this. And it was very long, because I just went on knitting. Anyway, I think he was really sort of having me on, rather. But you're not actually going to get out and look, see how many engines you've got.
You might start some kind of riot.
So, I mean, and mostly everybody was very good-humoured, and sure, we got very, very tired. I mean, I'd probably be up at 6 and not get to Cairo till 10 o'clock at night. And, you know, it's all been go, 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 go. And also, of course, people take it out of you. You know, I loved it. But all the while you've got to be fresh, as if they're the only one who ever counted. You've got to be get up in the morning at 6 o'clock and go around and say, hi, everybody, you know, good morning or whatever. My kids hated me because I'm a morning person, so they'd come down and say, ugh. And I'd say, good morning, you know. Well, lucky for me, I was a morning person. And I was like Churchill and Maggie Thatcher, in fact, I could catnap. So I could go up, and if we got quiet time, and sit on the floor in the cockpit and doze off for 10 minutes, quarter of an hour, and, you know, go back, do my face up and start again.